We begin now a series of 9 lectures that will take us 2 weeks to complete, in which we will primarily focus on the writings and the insights of St. Evagrius Ponticus, and to a lesser extent his disciple, St. John Cassian. I refer to these people as saints. They are both saints in different Christian calendars. Cassian is a saint, particularly commemorated in the Diocese of Marseille, although not in the Universal Church as much as he ought to be. Evagrius is not commemorated in the calendars of the Catholic or Orthodox churches at present. However, he almost made it in to the last updating of the Roman Martyrology, and he is celebrated as a saint in the Armenian and Coptic traditions and in the churches of the East, the churches that use Syriac as their primary language. And the reasons for this will become clear. Evagrius is one of the most important sources for the early Christian tradition of spiritual direction that we possess. And we're in a very good position now to be able not only to assess his works in the original, because they have been restored to us from relative obscurity, which we'll talk about in just a couple of minutes, but also from the perspective of the contribution that they make to our understanding not only of an historical epoch, but the language and insights into the workings of the human soul, the struggle with temptation and the struggle for virtue, and the classical ways of describing it in the Christian tradition. Evagrius is the one who bequeaths a tradition of terminology and insight which Cassian then takes up and translates into Latin and makes universal throughout the Western Church. It powerfully influences Western theology and Western ascetical theology in particular, primarily through Cassian's influence, but also to a considerably lesser extent through the fragmentary bits of Evagrius that continue to exist in Latin translation. In the Eastern Church, his influence is much more obvious because he is quoted and referred to not often by name, often under pseudonyms. And again, we'll see why that happened in just a few minutes. But suffice it to say that Evagrius is a tremendously insightful theologian, and today we would have to call him a psychologist as well, someone who understands and describes the working of the human mind and human heart and applies that to the experience of growth in Christian perfection, growth in holiness. So let's look briefly at his biography. We aren't going to look at all the details that you have before you, but you're welcome to go back and look at this biographical text if you wish. The point of it is primarily to highlight not only that Evagrius is profoundly Christian, he's born into a clerical family. His father was a core bishop, which is a kind of a wandering or movable cleric who undertakes responsibilities which the local bishop entrusted him with. He was not ordained to the episcopacy. That title is slightly misleading, but he was certainly a presbyter in rank and would have celebrated the Eucharist and probably been engaged in a reconciliation to the extent that that existed in the middle to latter a portion of the 4th century. And also, of course, in performing baptisms in remote locales. So that was Evagrius' father. He himself was placed in the clergy or assigned to work with St. Basil the Great. And this is one of the important points to note, that he received his theological instruction, that he was steeped in the tradition of the orthodoxy of Basil the Great, and then later Gregory Nazianzen, as we shall see. He also had some familiarity with Gregory of Nyssa, and was therefore part of the great movement of the Cappadocian Fathers, who provided the language for understanding the Trinity and the victory in the Eastern Church in particular of the Orthodox tradition represented by St. Athanasius over the Arian heresy. So he was a part of these very high and important and heady days, and as we'll see, he was also present at the Council of Constantinople in 381. So he was assigned to the clergy of St. Basil and lived under Basil, studied under him, was ordained by him to the office of lector. But Basil's death in 379 left him somewhat devastated. He found his way to Constantinople and then more or less apprenticed himself to St. Gregory Nazianzen, undoubtedly because of Basil's great familiarity with and recommendation of this other great theologian, who at this time was the emperor's representative in the project of converting the Eastern Empire back from Arianism to Orthodoxy. And this Gregory Nazianzen did primarily through the preaching of his theological orations. Evagrius would have been in Constantinople during the period when these orations were preached and was undoubtedly active in Gregory Nazianzen's clergy. When the Council of Constantinople took place, Evagrius was active in the council discussions and was renowned as being a very wise, balanced theologian. During the course of the council, through a variety of machinations that we needn't concern ourselves with, Gregory Nazianzen withdrew from Constantinople. He resigned his office because he was under a strong opposition, particularly from the clergy from Egypt. And Evagrius remained in Constantinople under the successor of Gregory Nazianzen, Nectarius. This successor also regarded Evagrius as a very able ally in theological projects, because Gregory had already ordained Evagrius to the diaconate by the time that he left. He was probably in Constantinople, Evagrius was, for not much more than 2 years. Nevertheless, the influence of Gregory Nazianzen, as I mentioned in section 1.4, was very deep and long-lasting. A second point to be aware of is that although Evagrius is often criticized as an uncritical originist, the reality is that through the influence of Basil and Gregory Nazianzen, his exposure to Origen would have been very careful and cautious. The two of them created a book called the Philokalia, which is not the same as the modern book that bears that same title. It literally means the love of the beautiful, in which Gregory and Basil put together the best writings of Origen, recognizing his limitations and problems. And Evagrius would certainly have had exposure to that tradition of reading Origen with both with reservation, but with an awareness of what could be used profitably. The next event in Evagrius' life is that through what amounts to a kind of a love affair, one-sided, a very highly placed noble woman who was married fell in love with Evagrius. Evagrius became very anxious and concerned about what the relationship might turn into, and he had a kind of a prophetic dream in which he experienced an angel encouraging him or commanding him to leave Constantinople. And on awakening, he wasn't quite sure whether he was bound to do what this angel had said, although he'd sworn an oath in the dream, but nevertheless, he did what he had promised in his dream and left Constantinople. He found his way to Jerusalem and soon became acquainted with the monastery founded by Melania the Elder and Rufinus. Melania was an extremely wealthy Roman noblewoman who, under the influence of Rufinus, had retired into monastic life, and the two of them had founded, Melania and Rufinus, a double monastery, a monastery which had a community both of men and of women living in a kind of appropriate and, but at the same time, a mutually nourishing relationship. And it was an intellectually advanced in community, in which there was a mixture both of sincere and deep spirituality and serious theological study as well. Evagrius was not a monk at this stage, but he was influenced, particularly as he fell ill and Melania advised him to renounce the world and become a monk as a condition for his healing, for which she would pray. Evagrius became a monk. He was clothed in the habit probably by Rufinus, and was sent by Melania and Rufinus to Egypt in order to undergo his deeper and more thorough monastic training. For 2 years he lived in Nitria, which, as we've noticed, is about 30 miles south of Alexandria. And after that, for the rest of his life, for the remaining 15 years of his life, he lived in the hermit colony of Kelia. and spent most of his time there, although he probably traveled quite regularly to Skeet or Skettus as well. He became a disciple of both Macarius the Great and Macarius the Alexandrian, very important desert fathers. He knew Didymus the Blind, a great intellectual and biblical commentator, and a great lover of Origen, who lived near Alexandria. And so Evagrius, well-educated, well-trained in theology, very rooted in Orthodox Christianity, now also absorbs the best of the desert tradition. He becomes a respected Abba, or spiritual teacher, and he becomes part of a group of monks who are particularly willing to try to use the language of classical philosophy and the less problematic insights of Origen as a way of articulating spiritual progress, spiritual growth, and they become a kind of a center for study and for learning, and Evagrius writes quite a lot during this period. Now, it's important to bear in mind something that you will not find in most texts about him, and that is that the overwhelming majority of Evagrius' writings are Bible commentaries. We've only come to realize this in the last 20 years or so. He wrote also spiritual texts, which we will be studying in some detail, but the majority of what he wrote were commentaries on the scriptures intended to help people read the scriptures at a very deep and contemplative level, to read the text as a way of going deeper into the presence of God, of seeing in the text of the scriptures reflections of one's own spiritual journey and indeed the journey of the whole cosmos into union with God. That's the majority of what he wrote, but what has come down to us and what was much more commonly known were his texts on spiritual growth, spiritual development, and struggle with temptation. As far as his lifestyle was concerned, you can see it described in sections 1-8 and 1-9. He often received visitors. He was a spiritual director. His biographer describes this activity of spiritual direction in some detail. He would see people in a kind of a group and then individually depending upon their particular needs, and he supported himself by copying manuscripts. Probably the monastery of Melania and Rufinus was a center to which he sent his own writings and from which they were copied and probably disseminated outside. He was deeply respected throughout the whole of his lifetime, and he died in the year 399, which was a very perfect time for him to die, because immediately, within a few months of his death, there was a kind of a convulsion, a political and theological upheaval in Egypt, having to do with what became known as the Anthropomorphite controversy. The Archbishop had tried to urge people to pray without holding a mental visual image of God as an old man. This probably was a reflection of the spiritual currents which Evagrius himself represents, as we'll see when we look at his text on prayer, but it was regarded with shock and horror by some of the simpler desert fathers who regarded this as taking their God away. So there were monks who attacked the episcopal palace in Alexandria, and Theophilus, through a variety of political machinations, finally agreed to side with them and to actually attack the Origenist monks of Egypt. So after Evagrius' death, the circles in which he'd moved and of which he'd been a part were actually sent off into exile, those who escaped with their lives. This had the positive effect of allowing their insight then to be disseminated throughout the empire, and one of the most significant of these exiles was undoubtedly John Cassian, who carried both his experience of Evagrius and the Desert Fathers, as well as his deep monastic training with him as he traveled around the Mediterranean, and again, this is Cassian, eventually settled in France, in the region near Marseille, as we'll talk about later. So Evagrius' writings and insights were propagated both by his writings and also by those who knew him, and particularly by Cassian, who translated his insights into Latin. However, in around 553 and a bit before, Evagrius' writings were condemned by the Emperor Justinian. The condemnation was very unfair. The sections of his writings that are quoted are rather obscure. They're quoted only in part. And notice that 553 is a considerable length of time after Evagrius' death. death. By this time, there were, it must be admitted, people who were using the writings of Evagrius and other texts in order to promote a very problematic spiritual theology and Christology, and it was in order to condemn these that the texts of their favorite writers were also condemned, Evagrius' writings among them, but also the writings of Didymus the Blind and Origen, of course. So, Evagrius' name began to be listed among the problematic and even condemned authors. However, his writings, especially his writings on spiritual growth and maturity, which we will be looking at, were so widely read, so widely appreciated, that they continued to be used under other names, particularly the names of Nihilus, occasionally Athanasius. And so his writings often survived under the names of other authors. And it's been a project of the 20th century to restore his writings to his own name, which has been done with a very high degree of certainty, and also to be able to recreate and rediscover his biblical commentaries, which has been a very exciting and important source of information in the area of spiritual theology, particularly in the last decade and a half or so. If we drop down to section 2 of this page, you'll see that I've provided you with a kind of a visual chart model of Evagrius' own model of spiritual progress. He has a threefold approach, and it's important that we not regard this simply as a series of steps or stages. He describes the practici, theoretici, which is subdivided into physici and theologici. We would call this the life of asceticism, which is the practici. The one who engages in ascetical practice is the practikos, which is usually associated with monasticism. And then the contemplative, the one who is engaged in this project of theoretici, is engaged in a contemplation of both God in creation, God in the mini, in the complex, which is technically called theoria physici, and also the ability to the experience of a transcendent sense of God's presence that is beyond word and beyond image, called theologici. Technically, this also refers to the theological project of trying to speak about or write about the divine nature, which of course was very important to Evagrius' teachers, Gregory of Nazianzen in particular, in trying to find the appropriate language to use to describe the relationship between the three persons of the Blessed Trinity. So theologici is both a contemplative experience of seeking to see, to perceive, to understand God, to have a sense of who God is, how God can be both one and three, but it's also a reaching beyond the capacity for word and image. And so this is a project that is ultimately one that leads to a transcendent experience of God. But they are not simply a stepwise progression. They are all elements or aspects of an ongoing rhythm, of an ongoing movement. Not all of those who engage in asceticism become contemplatives, according to Evagrius, and nor need they. Not all spiritual directors, spiritual abbas or amas, need to be contemplatives in his sense. That is to say, people who understand the deeper meaning of the scriptures, who can look beneath the surface and appreciate the very complex and beautiful mysteries of God within creation. Although it is helpful, and he would have said that probably the best spiritual director is one who is also a contemplative, one who can particularly see the heart of the other, the spiritual journey of the other, in a contemplative sort of way. But he did believe that you make real progress in the spiritual life as you begin to look at your own asceticism from an increasingly contemplative, light-filled, God-filled perspective. But he would also admit that it is not absolutely necessary to progress into a true understanding of the deeper mysteries in order to be able to advise others in regard to their spiritual lives. So this division or this model of spiritual development or progress has implications for spiritual direction, but it is not intended to be a kind of a description of a hierarchy that includes some and excludes others. Another point to note is that in the much later tradition, particularly in the 14th through the 17th centuries, these three aspects or phases became associated with the notions of purgation, illumination, and union, although they were understood in a somewhat different way and became descriptive of different ways or stages, which they really are not in Evagrius. To try to retrofit a much later model of a stepwise development onto a much more complex and interweaving model is to drastically misunderstand Evagrius' insight. So we have to regard these as three aspects of spiritual life, which ideally should all be present to varying degrees, but may not be all as prominent as each other at various times in one's spiritual journey, or indeed in certain individuals, depending upon their gifts or capacities. If you drop down to section 2.3, you'll see that I've given a more kind of chart-wise description, not as dynamic a description of that process. And then if you drop down to number 3, I've mentioned the fact, and we'll come up against this again and again, and please read this before moving on to the next section, before moving on to the next lecture. For Evagrius, not only is the spiritual journey understood in a kind of a threefold way, but the human psyche is tripartite, is threefold as well. And he takes this directly from the Aristotelian and Platonic tradition. The logistikon, or ruling faculty, is responsible for the virtues of prudence, understanding, and wisdom, and then the part of ourselves that is subject to addictions or compulsions, the pathetikon, is also a place where we have been gifted by God with our capacity for desire, epithumia, and indignation, or our ability to be righteously and properly indignant, called thumos. And these are terms taken over directly from the Platonic and Aristotelian traditions. The epithumetikon, or desiring part, is responsible for the classical virtues of temperance, love, and continence. The thumikon, this capacity for indignation, is responsible for courage and patient endurance. And so in number 3.3, I've given you a kind of a diagram using a picture of Elijah and his chariot to show the governing faculty with its virtues in black, and the patheticon, the desiring part, the epithumeticon, and strength, the thumicon, with its virtues as well. Justice, the fourth classical virtue, was thought of as residing within the whole of the soul. And then if you drop down finally to 3.5, something that we'll look at in much more detail, here is an expanded version of these three parts describing not only the virtues, but the vices of each part of the self, according to Evagrius's model, and one which he is borrowing to a certain extent, but adapting from the classical tradition. The virtues we've already mentioned, and then the misuse of the capacity, for example, of the logistikon, which becomes responsible for pride, vainglory, or ignorance in this higher or ruling part of the self, and then the part of the self subject to passion, subject to emotion, capable of being moved, which is what patheia means, capable of even being swept up. The virtues that one should acquire are listed in brown, and the vices are listed in blue. We'll come back again and again to this in Evagrius's model, but this is just a sort of a chart-wise way of listing them, to which you can refer later if you wish. And I've also given some biblical texts that are classically used, especially in Evagrius, but also in other authors, to point out a kind of an association between these different parts of the soul and the temptations that the Lord underwent at the beginning of his ministry.